So first, I'd like to say it's a pleasure to be on a panel with John. And also, I want to thank Alex and the other organizers of this festival, of this gathering, for inviting me to speak, but also for organizing all the very interesting, provocative, and insightful speakers who've given us a lot of food for thought. I'm sort of going to segue from John. As John has pointed out, you know, what he intended to say, you know, basically the core remained intact. But as he listened to presentations from various people, obviously he attenuated it to take into consideration those insights. And I'm going to talk about Cuba, and my talk was entitled Lessons from Cuba, you know, race, class, gender, sexuality, and revolution. I probably won't address all of those different things because the discussion is always, I find, much more fruitful and so forth. And I'm not going to, in a sense, talk about, but though this can be brought up in discussions, the ongoing economic reforms, the updating of the Cuban economic model, which has caused a lot of discussion on the left. What I do want to begin with, in a sense, is in sort of looking at the three questions that Alex posed us, was to talk about that Cuba has played a very important role in sort of my activism and so forth. So while, you know, I've been inspired by the civil rights movement, the Black Panther Party, the American Indian movement, national liberation, anti-colonial struggles, and I teach courses that focus on these, the Russian Revolution and so forth, the Cuban Revolution has been central. And I think one of the important points to bear in mind is the book I wrote, Cuba Revolution in Motion, which was published by Fernwood and Zed Books, was actually prompted by the fact that when I became active as an undergrad in the late 80s and so forth, you know, I was active in a leftist circle that looked upon Cuba, supported their national liberation struggle, their right to self-determination, but didn't see them as an emancipatory model. I mean, this was part of the old Sino-Soviet split. And so when the Soviet Union Eastern Bloc collapsed, and I'll come back to this point of this narrative that sort of writes out the people of the South, Cuba was expected to collapse. And any one of you here who's doing an honors or a master's thesis, you can do a very easy one by reading all of these scholars, all of the so-called prognosticators, all of the so-called Cubanologists, the specialists, who predicted that the Cuban Revolution would disappear overnight. And I remember there's a funny story that the one of the former Cuban ambassadors told me, Carlos Fernandez de Cosio, who is now works in the a very important person in the Cuban Ministry of Foreign Affairs, was that in 1991. You know, the Cuban economy was in a collapse, a precipitous collapse, and the Cubans for the first time were deciding they were going to put forward a resolution to condemn the U.S. economic warfare, what the U.S. calls the embargo. It's really a blockade, and in reality is a war against Cuba. So they're getting ready to put forward this resolution to be voted on against the United Nations. And for some reason, the United States didn't use some sort of maneuver to actually delay the vote on that and actually have the resolution tabled so it wouldn't be voted on in 1992. The U.S. didn't do that. So the Cubans got together and they had this discussion. What's up with the U.S.? And if the conclusion was, well, the United States didn't expect the Cuban Revolution to exist beyond 1991. It would collapse because everybody had predicted that. And of course, the revolution survived. And the revolution has survived, and I'm going to say, since all of these predictions of collapse. And what happened was that when I wrote this book, I wanted to challenge my own prejudices because I expected the revolution to collapse. I saw Cuba in sort of this prejudiced view as being simply a satellite or client state of the Soviet Union. So I was forced to interrogate my own thinking, right, to reevaluate it. And so my book was really written about how to explain, in a sense, why Cuba did not collapse as everybody had predicted, and why, for example, the vast majority of Cubans remain committed to the Cuban revolutionary project. So that's one thing we can sort of address in the discussion, why Cuba survived, and specifically what lessons can we draw from that. A second point, which I want to draw on as well, is this issue of the historical narrative. So the 20th century is normally presented in sort of, how shall we say, a very Eurocentric conception. History takes place in the North, either in Europe, Western Europe particularly, or in the Anglo-American world. And last, I think it was in the winter semester in February, John organized a panel in which we discussed, you know, 25 years since the fall of the Berlin Wall, which ushered in the collapse of the so-called socialism and the Eastern Bloc. And within this, I presented a paper on the end of apartheid. And one of the important points to bear in mind is part of the narrative that people believe in, especially which was hammered into our heads when Mandela passed away, was that the collapse of the end of apartheid is really a story of Western powers putting pressure on South Africa and forcing South Africa basically to decide, South African ruling class, that apartheid had to come to an end, right? You have, for example, Mulroney posturing that he told Margaret Thatcher, right? You know, that I told her to end it, right? Well, if you look at the facts, every year that Mulroney was in power, trade with South Africa during the apartheid years went up, right? So what has been written out of this, obviously, was the fact that central to the collapse of apartheid, one of the central elements in the collapse of the apartheid, was the defeat of South Africa's war of terrorism throughout the Southern African region. I'll give you some figures, for example. From 1981 to 1988, it's estimated that 500,000 Angolans alone died in Angola as a direct or indirect result of South African terrorism. And this war of terror that South Africa waged has been forgotten. In September of last year, I organized a conference, was chair of the organizing committee of a conference at the University of Toronto that focused on this unknown war. And central to this defeat of South Africa's war of terror was Cuba, which has been forgotten. This is a magazine, I'm showing up here. This is New African Magazine, which at one time was the most popular and the most widely circulated magazine on Pan-Africanism. And when Fidel Castro retired in 2006, this was the headline. And it's a whole, he's a feature article of a series of articles of various African leaders talking about Cuba's central role in defeating the South African army in Angola. And what's interesting is in that historical narrative, which I bought into in the early, in the late 80s and so forth, was that Cuba was merely a surrogate, puppet troops for the Soviet Union. This has been disproven time and time again by a whole number of documents. And the book I'm working on, which is based on my PhD dissertation, you know, carries that forward as a bit. Cuba played a central role, and this has been written out of historical narrative. So these are some of the issues that I think are important. What are some of the lessons of the Cuban Revolution? I think one of the things that obviously is a segue from what John was talking about, and which I've focused a lot on Cuba, is the authentic and indigenous thought material of the Cuban Revolution. People often like to think of the Cuban Revolution simply, and the ideology that has driven the Cuban Revolution, as simply being some sort of import either from the Soviet Union or basically, you know, their own interpretation of Marxism, Leninism, and so forth. Cuba does not have, the idea that Cuba does not have Indian independent thought material. Anyone who studies the Cuban Revolution, and I recommend as a book that's also published by Fulmer called Jose Marti, mentor of the Cuban Revolution, and who played a very central role in Cuban thought material. I also recommend, a book by Luis Perez, who's considered a dean of Cuban historians, called Cuba Between Reform and Revolution. And what those books demonstrate is that at the heart of the Cuban intellectual movement that leads to the revolution is their own autochthonous thinking. I mean, they may learn from other people, but they're doing their own thinking and drawing on their own indigenous thinkers, right? So I think one of the important points to bear in mind here that has come out, I think, out of one of the failings of the left in the West is not only the idea that history takes place in the North, in Western Europe, in the Anglo-American world. I mean, there's a famous quote, for example, by Kissinger, who made a comment in regards, this is when Allende was elected. Don't these Chilean, I mean, in regards to the Chilean people, don't they know that the axis of history in our time runs from Washington to London to Moscow and to Tokyo, right? And then when he discovered that the Cubans in 1975 had actually dispatched troops into Angola, and they dispatched troops on their own decision, it was their own independent decision, the Soviets actually didn't approve of it, and actually they did it at the request of the Angolan government. He was so stunned, and he said, you know, don't these Cubans know, right, and that they are not makers of history, right? They were so stunned. So one of the important points that comes along with this idea that people of the South are more hapless, helpless spectators on the stage of world history is we're incapable of doing our own thought. And one of the things I've railed against, okay, and I think is the ideas, particularly from so-called well-meaning leftists, whether it be they Marxists or what have you from the North, is this belief that they will support the right of self-determination of people from the South only so long as people from the South self-determine self-determine in the way that they wish them to self-determine, right? Okay, and I think that's a very particularly unfruitful and racist form of thinking. I mean, you can see it, for example, in terms of what's unfolding in Latin America, and I'm kind of going off on what I really wanted to speak about, but I think it's an important point. People are incapable, a lot of leftists, and I can name a few of their names, but for politeness, I will not, who talk about and who cannot understand in the South why it has been so critical that indigenous peoples have affirmed themselves as indigenous peoples. That does not mean class is not a very important, and in fact, maybe a primary axis of analysis. But the issue is that before they looked upon the indigenous peoples, be they in Bolivia, for example, the Aymara, the Quechua, and so forth, the Guaranin, or other indigenous peoples throughout Latin America, as in terms of peasants, right? In terms of the relationship to the means of production, the relationship to the state. But the fact that indigenous peoples can affirm themselves with dignity has been a very important material force in that society. Material in the sense that once people begin to believe in their self-worth, okay, as Marx himself said, when ideas grip a people, it becomes a material force in society, so of the paraphrasm. So this important aspect of indigenous peoples asserting their dignity and then drawing on their own indigenous oral histories, philosophies, and thought material has become critically important. And some prominent writers have been unable to appreciate this particular phenomena and understand why it's so critically important. Because for them, and I go through a lot of left sites. I mean, that's unfortunately, one of the things about becoming involved in Cuba Solidarity in the 1990s was that suddenly one found yourself under a tent. I'm involving people from various tendencies within the movements, a lot of them from so-called Marxist movements, one of them believing they were the sole legitimate heirs of the correct Marxist analysis, but you found yourself in the same tent with people who supported Cuba but came from different tendencies, but who, if they had held power before the Soviet Union and Eastern Bloc had collapsed, probably would have imprisoned or executed the other people from those tendencies. So one of the things, as part and parcel of defending Cuba, I've read everything, and I read all of the left-wing sites, okay? And one of the things that stands out in all of this is the inability, right, okay, to appreciate that people have other ways of thinking, that there have been other contributions to the treasury of human intellectual achievement by people who are from the global South. And then it's interesting, there's one particular website which I shall not mention that's very popular. It's a so-called Marxist website, very popular across the world. And every intellectual, every contribution to human thinking that they acknowledge always tends to be European. I've never seen a black thinker, for example, or an indigenous thinker who has been valorized by them. So it's almost a repetition of the idea, okay, that undergirded colonial empire, undergirded the imperial project, sort of the idea of the white man's burden articulated by Rudyard Kipling, who actually wrote that poem to justify the U.S. conquest of the Philippines, and then it becomes sort of this very poetic justification for the European imperial project in Africa and elsewhere. It's sort of that recapitulation that those of the South, we are, you know, hewers of wood and drawers of water, we are the people who perform the manual labor, but we're incapable of any sort of intellectual contribution to society, right? And I find this has been replicated several times in the most active sectors of the left. I mean, sometimes, you know, unconsciously and undeliberately reproduced, and sometimes, I would say, deliberately reproduced. That's one aspect. Another lesson I think we can learn from Cuba as well is that with all the things that are unfolding in Cuba, and I'm not trying to paint Cuba as obviously a romanticized society, there have been made, serious errors have been made, is the necessity of holding state power. And that's why Cuba was able to survive the economic crisis, and that's why Cuba, for example, has been able to engage in a very interesting exercise in the expansion of the cooperative sector in the economy. State power is essential, but it is not a sufficient condition. Because within this, as well, the issue of avoiding dogmatism. Within Cuba, for example, there has been an ongoing debate against dogmatism. So, for example, some people are probably familiar now that Cuba went through a very homophobic phase in the Cuban Revolution and now has probably become the least homophobic society in Latin America, clearly, in the Latin America and the Caribbean, right? And Mariela Castro has carried on significant work. On the issue of race, which is an area focused on tremendously, they've made significant inroads. They went from the position with dealing with race as an epiphenomena that would necessarily disappear as you constructed socialist society, the realization that race itself, racism, okay, as we like to talk about racial capitalism, is how capitalism emerged itself. Theoretically, you can make the argument that capitalism does not need racism. I mean, you'll find other ways to sort of divide people. But how it historically emerged and evolved, racism was an integral part of that. And therefore, to talk about capitalism without talking about racism being a fundamental component of how it's evolved, how it functions, is to basically ignore reality. And the Cubans are fundamentally recognizing that now with a very rich debate over this particular issue of race and sexuality. But it's the revolution and step out that's created this kind of space, okay, for this kind of significant debate as well, to challenge this kind of dogmatism. And within this challenge of dogmatism, I would argue that despite the way Cuba is often portrayed in the media, that there's a significant amount of people's participation in decision making. I'll give you one example that's emerged, several examples. I mean, on the issue of sexuality, for example, there's been a lot of influence on that from different sections of the Cuban society who raised this particular issue. But I'll give you one example that happened in the early 90s. As the Cuban economy faced the economic crisis, I mean, almost a catastrophe in the face of the Soviet Union collapse. And I'll give you an example. Before the collapse began in 1990, 85%, or more 85% of the Cuban economy was entwined with the Soviet Union. I mean, you can think of Canada being entwined with the United States, almost similar figures, but Cuba was entwined with the Soviet Union. When the Soviet Union collapsed from 1990 to the middle of 1994, the Cuban economy declined by over 35%. That's greater than the Great Depression of the 1930s. Cuba went from receiving around 11 million tons of oil a year from the Soviet Union to less than 5 million. The whole economy went into a massive economic crisis, right? Food became in short supply because there was not enough fuel, okay, to actually get the food transported from the farms into the cities. Basically speaking, you know, there were no spare parts to repair cars and so forth. Cars disappeared from the streets. One of the things that happened was that food supplies became so stretched that, you know, Cubans had a number of jokes. They began to refer to the refrigerator as the coconut, because just like the coconut, all it had in it was water. And of course, you know, meat became, I mean, I know we're lots of vegetarians here, but meat became in short supply. So one of the other jokes that was going around Cuba was that one day, you know, Mr. Potato is running down the Cuban streets, and he's running, and a bunch of Cubans are chasing him. And as the potato, you know, is running from these Cubans, he turns a corner, and he sees a steak, and the steak is leaning up against the wall, sunning. And the potato says, Mr. Steak, a bunch of Cubans are chasing me down. They're going to eat me. But when they see you, you won't even last a second. Steak says, don't worry, man. They don't even remember what I look like. Okay? And they ran on, right? So there were all of these things. There were television programs on how to cook banana peels and so forth. It became that, right? There was an outbreak of optic neuropathy because of a lack of vitamin A and so forth. Over 60,000 people suddenly went blind, and the Cubans had to import all of these different things. So the Cuban Revolution was on the verge of collapse, and nobody knew what was going to happen. So in August of 1993, at Cuba's National Assembly, which is Cuba's national parliament, equivalent, you would say, to the House of Commons, the Ministry of Finance came forward with a number of emergency measures, right? And some of these included imposing, for the first time ever in the history of the Cuban Revolution, which triumphed on January 1st, 1959, a tax on workers' wages, right? And some other cost-cutting austerity measures. These were, you know, unheard of in time of the Cuban Revolution. A debate broke out in that parliament, the so-called rubber stamp parliament, right? A debate broke out, and representatives of the union said, we could not vote for this, okay, unless it was discussed amongst the people. So what happened was, in the midst of this discussion, you know, Fidel Castro gave a speech where he said, you know, I don't trust economists. I know politics, but I don't trust economists, right? So the National Assembly was suspended. And from September of 1994 to January of 1994, over 80,000 meetings took place across Cuba, involving over 5 million Cubans. And the population at that time is just over 11 million people. I think it was 5.5 million people involved. 80,000 meetings. And at those meetings, a fundamental consensus was formed that one, okay, to defend the Cuban Revolution, the gains in healthcare, education, okay, social security and independence, which is a very important part of the Cuban Revolution. It fought for its independence from the United States and also for social justice. But at the same time, to engage in these emergency measures and not to have a tax on wages and to distribute the cost evenly across the society so they could survive. And this formed the basis of the decisions that were taken later and so forth. So a consensus was reformed. And time again in the Cuban Revolution, in the promulgation of the criminal code, the promulgation of the constitution, the discussion of the latest economic measures, Cuba has engaged in times of intense national debate and discussion, almost a parliamentarization of the entire island, involving the vast majority of the country to come to a consensus on what should we do to overcome the current problems. And the consensus always comes back to defend the historic gains of the revolution, independence and what they call the social conquest, these pillars, and then also to take on measures to carry on the revolution and so on. And that's people's participation. And within that, you have a significant debate that takes place, and you have a challenge of dogmatism and so forth. The last point I'd like to also mention here, linked to this attack on dogmatism, is what I think is something that plagues the left, many other things, is perseveration, i.e. the belief that one, we can keep on doing things in the same old way while the conditions that made and justified what we do, okay, what we did in the past no longer exist, right? And I think one of the issues to bear in mind is the belief that we can actually return to the old way, the old social arrangements, return to the welfare state, return to the so-called New Deal, or at least to resurrect that. I think we have to recognize as well that we're living in a much more dangerous world. It was mentioned yesterday when Chris spoke about the all-sided destruction, okay, that's unfolding, and one of the great dangers we face is imperialist war. And imperialist war is probably the most destructive aspect of the imperialist system. So we face these things. And I think we need to face that we now live in a time of war. We now live in a time in which we face the outbreak of an even greater global conflagration than World War II. And I think we need to understand that within this, we need to come up with new particular forms of arrangements, right? New ways of thinking about things. So in the case of the Cuban Revolution, what they are engaged in at this point in time, after massive consultation, is an updating of the economy. Is an attempt, basically, as I said before, to accomplish no small feat. It's to deal with and resolve the world economic crisis that we're all engulfed in a way that is in the favor of their people, which is no small feat, given to a small island of 11.2 million people, given that it's an island that faces a constant warfare from the United States, and as much as, and I hope I know, since 2008, all of you are disabused of illusions about Barack Obama. And I remember, and I'm going to end on this point, I remember when Obama was elected in November of 2008, I rather, not foolishly, but rather, wasn't tactical, told people, well, you're all going to be disillusioned. He has now been voted as the so-called nice-looking face of U.S. imperialism, right? And I predicted he'd be even worse than George Bush. And I had friends, you know, in the black community, you know, my friends, you know, who began to ostracize me and broke up friendships. And now they don't talk about Obama because they realize what's unfolded, right? Okay? Obama has actually prosecuted the U.S. economic war against Cuba more diligently than George W. Bush ever did. More diligently than George W. Bush ever did. In the Office of Foreign Asset Control, which is a special agency in the United States, you know, and these are the people who will, you know, follow Iran, will so-called follow Al-Qaeda, the so-called war on terror, which is really a war of terror waged by U.S. imperialism. But they have more people set aside to ensure that the Cuban economy is punished, okay? That is, for example, if any bank, because, you know, most of the transactions on the world economy takes place in U.S. dollars. So any bank, for example, like UBS in Switzerland, if they deal with Cuba and they have to do this transaction in U.S. dollars, they can be fined. And they were fined $100 million recently. There's a whole bunch of banks being fined, right? They diligently do that. This puts pressure on the Cuban economy. So for Cuba to engage in updating its economy, preserve universal health care, preserve education, advance gender inequality, fight the negative tendencies that have emerged in Cuba around issues of racial equality and so forth, to do all of this in the context of an ongoing U.S. economic war, right, makes things extremely difficult. Right? But what they're able to accomplish, I would argue, is based on the fact that a mass people's movement who are actively involved in participating in politics, who are actively are drawing on their own indigenous thought material from Hathaway, who was the first internationalist in the post-Columbian era, we can chat about him later, to Jose Marti, to Juan Antonio Mella, I can name them Carpentier, Nicolas Goyen, a whole number, even including Fidel Castro, and other thinkers, because we have to avoid this kind of Fidel male-centric conception of Cuba, which has been imposed on us from the West. They draw on their own authentic thought material, okay, as opposed to simply implementing Eurocentric conceptions of Marxism and other emancipatory and liberatory frameworks. By drawing on this indigenous thought material, by involving people in decision-making, Cuba has not only been able to forge this historical consensus to defend independence, to defend the social conquest of the revolution, but to correct, you know, some of the very grievous errors they have made, and they have acknowledged this, right? So this creates this kind of space and so forth. The last point I'd like to make on this whole issue is that we're all involved in this struggle. And I think one of the important points that comes out from the question of the Cuban Revolution, but the struggles of other people, is sort of a certain humbleness that must come. Okay, and with what's emerging in Latin America, and Latin Americans asserting themselves on their own footing. There used to be this saying from the 60s, and I'm sure some people remember it, you know, this great humanity has said enough and has stood up and now marches on, right? I think we have to understand this great humanity has said enough, has stood up and marches on, and is thinking it's on its own two feet. It's drawing on its own intellectual traditions. So there's an arrogance that's associated with a lot of Western thinkers, a lot of Western academics, a lot of Western leftists, right, that sort of think that thinking and rationality is a European preserve, okay, and that the so-called non-white peoples of the world, those of the South, are somehow incapable of carrying on their own struggles, carrying on their own analysis, coming up with their own liberatory frameworks. And Cuba, a small island, 11.2 million people, much maligned in the mainstream media, is carrying on. I always like to say that, you know, one of the interesting things is that as Cuba's going on with this update of its economy, it's going where no one has gone before, but it's going there with a plan. So, and it's based on its own experience, its own thought material, and without any degree of dogmatism or arrogance. Thank you.